Oscar Podcast.
And this is how it starts.
Sasha Stone from awardsdaily.com. Today we've seen Zero Dark Thirty and Les Mis and Life of Pi, and we'd like to talk about those movies and also how we think that's shaping up the Best Picture race. And then, of course, how the Best Actress race has just been changed by Zero Dark Thirty. Okay, so the first movie we're going to talk about is Life of Pi, because it's doing surprisingly well. Like, it got some kind of bad reviews when it first came out, but it seems to be the movie a lot of people are talking about and a lot of people are going to see. It did really well at the box office. I haven't looked at the final box office numbers yet, but it did well. And it turned out to be, you know, we all three loved it, and Ryan, you especially loved it.
I loved it. I love the book. I've loved the book for, 10 years or 5 years since I read it. And so I kind of knew it inside out because I'd read it 2.5 times. I didn't want to read it a third time all the way through because I wanted the movie to surprise me some. And it was one of the really rare instances where I think the movie actually improves on the novel.
Wow.
I think the movie helped distill the novel. And the novel has some pacing problems, I would say. I was a little bit impatient at times with the novel, but the movie eliminated all those problems, and it was just beautiful. I think that Lincoln is probably the greatest movie of the year. There's no other movie that touched me as much as Life of Pi.
Yeah, I hear you on that. I took my daughter and her cousin and their friend to see it, and they were like 14, 15, and they were riveted. They loved it, and they kept talking about it afterwards, you know. So it's like the second movie that this younger generation has seen, and they loved, you know. They were totally into it. I didn't know if they'd be able to handle the kind of the spiritual aspect of it, because to me it's a great movie all the way through, but it's really about, for me, it's about the end, the last scene.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the whole movie's about, mm-hmm. you know.
I think what Brian says about it sort of touching a nerve with him is very, very important, and is why it's a movie that it shouldn't be underestimated, even though, like you said, it got some harsh reviews to begin with. It's the kind of movie that touches certain people in certain ways, and when that happens, you can maybe look at things that other people consider flaws, and they don't really bother you. You're just responding to the way that the movie moves you and the way it makes you feel, whereas you can look at a movie like Lincoln and think of all of its technical aspects and how brilliant it is and how smart it is and how important it is, but at the end of the day, if it doesn't hit you in the gut, it doesn't have quite the same impact. And in my case, I'm thinking of The Master, which is a wonderful film, and it was a spectacular filmmaking, but for me, it didn't quite have that extra layer. That indescribable something that just grabs you and moves you, that Life of Pi seems to have with people who are responding to it.
And the people who don't respond too, I don't want to argue with them about it. I don't feel like that I have to argue or have to try to convince anyone. What I treasure about it, what I cherish is I almost want to keep it to myself, and I don't even want to plead the case for it. It's as if almost, It's hard to. It's sort of like the way you feel about your favorite song. You know that you. We all have favorite songs for various reasons. We don't believe that's the greatest song ever written. And we don't try to convince other people to love the song that we love. We just love it, and it doesn't matter if other people look at us kind of crazy if they don't appreciate our taste in music. But you don't feel like you need to fight about it. You know, you just keep it for yourself, and that's the way I feel about Life of Pi.
I kind of agree with that, but at the same time, there's some things that were said about it before I actually saw it that I wound up kind of strenuously disagreeing with it. It seems like one of the big criticisms about it is that it's simplistic, or somehow the themes of it are obvious and heavy-handed and overly repeated. And I didn't really find that at all. I thought that it was actually – it kind of held its cards close to its vest for a very long time until near the end, and it sort of – reveals what the bigger picture is, and the stuff that it's dealing with to me are fundamental things about human beings and how they deal with the world around them. And I can't think of many things that are bigger or more powerful than that. And the fact that it doesn't tell you what to think, it leaves it up there for you to decide for yourself. It's not very often that movies do that.
Right. I know, it's true. And I started out this whole Life of Pi journey for me was this guy who on Twitter had seen it at a test screening and was dissing it and saying it was about finding God in a boat and that it was a pro-Christianity movie. And Jeff Wells wrote a big long thing about how it was a pro-God, pro-Christianity movie. Well, upon seeing it, I realized that that is a really one-dimensional way of looking at it and a total misread of what the story is. I've never read the book, but I can tell you that the movie isn't about imposing religion at all. In fact, it very, you know, clearly states that it's really about a choice of believing one story or another, you know, and mm-hmm. how I was talking to Emma about this and how, you know, a lot of us atheists and a lot of us like to believe that we, you know, it's not true unless we can prove it, and it's not true unless we can see it. And faith is about having faith, whether you can prove it or is irrelevant. And it's beside the point. You know, faith is faith. And that's what I liked about Life of Pi is it presents that dilemma. It presents that conflict. And it's all about, you know, I think, Craig, you were saying this, he needs the tiger because the tiger is sort of the animal side of nature, right? And not spiritual side. It's both. The movie is about both. It's about mankind's ability to see and understand their world and also reach other dimensions and notice beauty and see life as beautiful and all that stuff, all wrapped up in one movie, proven at the end, you know, that's what it's about. I made you guys really quiet.
I'm just listening to what you said because I hadn't heard that Craig said that, but that's really, I like it a lot and I hadn't thought of it that way. But the tiger is sort of like, it's the animal will to survive. The animal's, absolute, you know, necessity to survive at all costs. And which we all have to have within us, I guess, in order to keep going and to survive illness and things like that and hardship and other living things that are not as conscious. Like animals all have that same will to survive and will do anything at any cost to survive. Right. But then humans have another side to us, the nature when we wonder what that's all about and we wonder if that's all there is.
Right, right.
Right, and a tiger doesn't waste its time with fuzzy ideas about God or faith or spirituality or morality or anything like that. The tiger just does what the tiger does to survive, and to a large extent, humans do as well, but we have this whole other part of our brain on top of that that tries to analyze why we do the things that we do. And I think it's dangerous to call the movie a testament to Christianity. There was a period in it when I was fearing that was what was going to happen, but by the end, it sets up with the exact same argument a perfect defense for spirituality and a perfect takedown of spirituality, mm-hmm. all at the same time, and is oddly content with that. It's not trying to twist your arm to think one thing or another. It's simply trying to sort of explain the phenomena and why it's important.
And how much of a relief it can be to decide that. You know, that for me, that's what really happened to me, what really opened that dimension of my mind, because I really am an atheist, a committed atheist. And at the same time, I fear death greatly. And I'm tortured by what it all means, looking around. Like, what the fuck? All this, really? And then we're just going to disappear? And then we disappear and life goes on without us? Well, what's going to happen? What's going to happen with life? You know, when am I going to get to that point where I'm like my grandmother and I'm totally out of touch with reality? And, you know, people look at me and go, oh, she's so out of a different time. You know, like, what's my time and what's the time coming next? And it all is speeding by so fast. And then I saw Life of Pi, and it's kind of like, yeah, but, you know, you can look at it that way. Or you can choose to look at it this way. And the choice is the relief. It doesn't mean anything one way or the other definitively. Because I choose to see life that way wouldn't mean that there's no such thing as science and that it's all about religion. It, you know, it's not an either-or kind of thing. It's just really about psychic relief.
And I think that Pi the person, Pi the character in the movie, in the novel, and Pi the movie itself, what I like about both them, and it's personified by the guy, by the actor who plays Pi, is he doesn't proselytize. He's not a missionary. He's not trying to convince the guy. In fact, when the writer comes and one of the first things he says to him is this guy told me that I have to come and get you to tell me the story because you tell me the story and I'll believe in God.
Right.
And Pi is almost amused by that. He's amused by it, and he doesn't want to put that. He doesn't want to accept that pressure. And he says, "I'll tell you the story, and you will believe what you want to believe."
Right, right. And I love exactly. And he. I loved it at the end of that. He said, and it's your story now. Mm-hmm. So by the end of it, you don't even know if it was really a story or not. You know, it's your story now. He says, this is supposed to make you believe in God.
And I will say that's one of the things that's one of the great things that the screenplay for the movie did that really improved upon the movie. Do you know that the part about the writer only exists in the preface to the book? It's only like the first seven or eight pages of the book. And that's it. The writer is just sort of, it's like one of those prefaces or forwards to a book that you know is a work of fiction, but they try to make it act. The writer throws another layer on top of it, as if I'm going to tell you the story that I heard, and that's what it's like. But that's the last you see of the writer in the novel. It's just the very first seven or eight pages, and so the screenplay. It's an amazing thing they did with that to expand all that out and to frame it, use it as a framing device instead of just. Instead of just hinting at it.
Right, right.
Makes the story more approachable and gives
an end
to the story and also provides closure for the story.
It's a really brilliant technique of adaptation. I really hope enough people... It's the kind of screenplay expertise that I think the UC Scripter people are really going to love. I think the screenplay and book have a really good chance of winning the UC Scripter Award.
No, Lincoln's going to win that.
Oh, you think?
Oh, yeah. 10 years to write one of the most famous books of all time, the only book that Obama brought into the White House. There's no way she loses. And then Tony Kushner, one of the most well-respected writers.
But who are the weird team of monks that even vote on this award? Do we even know?
They're faculty at USC, I think, right?
And a lot of them are industry people, you know, like Robert Towne and people like that. You know, so
faculty and alumni maybe of USC.
Yeah,
right. Lincoln for the win. You heard it here first, everybody.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because everyone is really hanging on the winner of USC Scripter Award.
I'm like the only one that
cares about
it.
On that day when that's announced, the traffic is through the roof.
I've been the only person who reports on the Scripter. I swear, nobody else cares.
It's important to me, though. Traffic. I really like that award.
I do, too. I like it, too, Ryan. I feel like it's a sort of an weirdly honest award.
It
went up in the air one.
It doesn't seem political. That's the thing about it. It doesn't seem ever very political, does it?
Mm-mm. No, it seems like it really does try to do what it's supposed to do, which is honor the adaptation.
Those people are uncorruptible. Whoever they are, whoever votes on it, I have the feeling that you can't bribe them with stuff.
Right, I don't think so either. I think it's pretty on the up and up, you know.
I guess I'm implying that all the other awards is all the result of bribery. That's not what I mean.
Oh, God. Well, we've seen too much, haven't we? We just seen too much. We know too much. So I finally saw Tom Hooper's Les Miserables. Craig and I saw it over the weekend. The movie was sort of lost on me because I never read the play. I never saw the play. I've never read the book. I'm a heathen for not having read the book. And so to me, the movie was whether or not I liked the songs. And there were a couple of songs I really liked. I think Anne Hathaway is great. And her song was really chilled me to the bone. Every scene she's in is great. And I feel like the movie really suffers when she leaves the screen. And I think a lot of people are going to be, I think it's going to be a divisive film. You're going to love it or you're going to hate it. Some people are going to just be kind of shrug their shoulders and say that was okay, but they won't connect with it. But I think the people who love it will really love it. But I think that makes it a tough sell for an Oscar winner, maybe a nominee. But
since I haven't seen it, since I wasn't lucky enough to see it, can I ask, do you think that it was because was it difficult in some ways to understand some of the right relationships between the characters or exactly what was happening at times? Is that why you didn't get into it as much, do you think?
I didn't have that problem. I understood the plot. I understood the relationships between the characters.
Maybe that's the wrong way to put it then.
There were a lot of characters, but it wasn't that complicated. It was actually surprisingly simple considering how long it is.
Well, I didn't understand who Russell Crowe was supposed to be. I get that he was sort of symbolic of the army, the French army. You know, he was on the military side, I guess. But who was he in the beginning, and why was he chasing after Cosette? And, you know, why did he want Cosette? And why, you know, I didn't understand why he kept turning up every 5 seconds singing.
He was the cop, and he was obsessed with finding out what's his name? Valjean. He was obsessed with this idea that this guy had broken the law and he was going to bring him to justice at any cost. That was pretty much his motivating factor throughout the entire film.
Right. So I guess if you have the aristocracy and you have the poor, and in the middle you have the law who's supposed to enforce the law, even though it's an unfair situation because the aristocracy, it's kind of like how it's like in America. But that's true, but I guess I never got the complexities in Russell Crowe's character, as in I'm torn because I'm a citizen of France and yet I have to carry out the law. It just didn't, nothing he did or said made any sense, or sang made any sense to me at all. And then there's a parallel love story between that one guy that you're interviewing tomorrow and Cosette. He's in love with her, and then Samantha Barks is in love with him, and there's all these millions of songs in between all about that.
Yeah, I think I'm going to be lost. I'm even more of a heathen than you. So I don't even know except one song from the musical. I couldn't even name one song except the one that's famous, the most famous one. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really ignorant about this movie and about the plot and everything else. Maybe I need to see the other movie, the Les Miserables, that's based on the novel. Maybe I'll do that to kind of educate myself a little bit before I see the musical.
I wish I had. But that's the thing, is that when you enter an Andrew Lloyd Webber universe, that's it. I mean, you have to really be prepared for it, I think, because what Tom Hooper did was he decided to take a stage play, put it to screen, but not really modify it. What he did was have everybody singing live, and he filmed them in extreme close-ups, all of them, all the time, most of the time. And so the actors are kind of worried about singing, you know, because they're singing live, and there's not a lot of time to collect your thoughts and figure out how you feel about something, because 2 seconds later is a new song, and it's just solid singing.
I have to ask questions because I haven't seen it, so maybe I'm like the interviewer for this segment.
Yeah.
When they sing, are they solos or are there songs where they sing with someone else, so there's a dialogue going on at times?
Both.
Hopefully.
There's some dialogue like, "What are you doing here, sir? I am coming to see you." and then the launch into
Okay. That's and then when you say, oh, no.
No, but that's what it is. I mean, I think if you love the musical and you love all those songs, it's going to be like your catnip. You're just going to go nuts for it. But if you're like me and you've never, you've only heard the songs occasionally here and there, like on American Idol or whatever, but you've never got them in context, you know, what was left for me was the three women I thought were really good, especially Anne Hathaway, but also Samantha Barks is really good in the part that she plays, and her singing is great, and her acting is great while she sings. And then Amanda Seyfried, who is hardly in it. She's got like two songs. And Anne Hathaway's there at the beginning, and she's great, but then
and
she goes away.
How many songs does she have? Just how many?
Just a couple.
How much screen time would you say she has?
Oh, 20 minutes.
Okay.
Maybe. Would you say 20 minutes, Craig, for her?
Yeah, and it's all crammed into the first 45 minutes of the movie. Once she checks out, it's another hour and 45 minutes without her.
But it's really good. Her part is really good. It's Oscar winning.
All the hype about her going in is justified, and I think even people who aren't going to warm up to the movie will have to acknowledge that she's terrific in it, both as a singer and as an actor while she's singing.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to remember that it's not going to be everybody's cup of tea, but there are going to be a hardcore group of people who are deeply passionate about it. And for me, it just boils down to whether those people are enough to put it over the top in terms of an Oscar favorite. I suspect not, but I'm prepared to be totally wrong about that. I mean, if the SAG crowd will probably go for it because they're obviously going to appreciate the acting that goes on in it, and that's the biggest branch of the Academy. But I'm having a hard time picturing some of the older, more fuddy-duddy sort of voters going for it. But it remains to be seen how it breaks down.
To me, it feels like everybody on the planet has seen this, but me. To go by the chatter on Twitter and to go by the conversations on the site, it seems like everyone knows this play inside out. And so, but can that be true? Surely there must be other people like me who are really don't know hardly anything about it, right?
How
are they going to get into it? Even get into the fact about getting into the groove of this talking, of everything being in all the dialogue being in lyrics. It's a leap to ask people to make who are uninitiated, I guess is what I'm saying. Unless you're inclined to already love it, and the only way that you would already love it is if you've already seen it, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right.
Is there anybody who's really going to love this movie except for people who've already are really familiar with it?
I'm not sure. It's really hard for me to know. All I know is that for me, I felt kind of locked out, you know, locked out of an inside joke or, you know, a thing that everybody else was sharing that I couldn't quite get into. Now, that's not the first time that's ever happened to me. I have to admit that, you know, all the readers and a lot of commenters will give me crap about how they think that I'm just holding resentments against Tom Hooper and that's why I didn't like it. Well, it's really kind of true and kind of not true. It's true in the way that that I left the King's Speech not quite getting it. Like, I was moved by Colin Firth and Jeffrey Rush, but to me it did not seem in any way, shape, or form like a great film or even close to being a great film. It was an okay movie, but not the greatest thing I've ever seen. But other people disagree with me on that. So that shows that I was emotionally cut off from what made that film great. I totally own that. And I didn't think it would win Best Picture in the beginning before it started winning stuff. I didn't think it was good enough. But it's kind of different with Les Mis. It's not that I don't think it's good enough. I just think it's going to be too divisive, whereas King's Speech was anything but divisive. It was like, hi, I appeal to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Silver Linings Playbook in this race is that movie. That's the one.
Argo, too, I think.
Or Lincoln. Those three.
Lincoln, I think, is a little more divisive simply because it does take a little bit of effort on the part of the audience to commit to a movie about process, whereas Argo and Silver Linings Playbook are sort of calculated to be easy to swallow.
Yeah. And they have the thriller aspect to them that propels an uninitiated audience along, as if you wouldn't have to know. You wouldn't even have to know Argo is a true story in order to enjoy it.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Enjoy it as an adventure, as a...
And it's a really good movie. It's a really, mm-hmm. really entertaining crowd pleaser, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is very similar to, that.
Does Les Mis, with so many close-ups, does that infringe on the epic feel of it? Because it seemed like it's pretty epic in the trailers. A lot of big backgrounds and lavish sets and everything, but you don't really have that much sense in the movie itself?
I didn't particularly. And Chris Tapley was going on and on about how it was going to be a record-breaking number of nominations. And either I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about, which is entirely possible. I'll totally cop to that if it turns out to be true. Or, you know, the movie that I saw was kind of like, you know, yeah, it might get some tech nods, but I wasn't particularly blown away by the art direction. I wasn't particularly blown away by the costumes. The cinematography was fine. It wasn't anything to write home about. But it doesn't, you know, so like, for instance, if you're talking about the other branches in the Academy, you're not necessarily talking about theater geeks. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how well it's going to do in that. It's not like there are so many tech-heavy movies, crafts-heavy movies this year, like Anna Karenina, that are better.
Mm-hmm.
Not better. I'm sorry. I should say.
But more
accessible.
Easily accessible.
Yeah. So, you know, that have the things like art direction and costumes and you know, visual effects and all that. But it just might be too powerful of a PR force to deny. You know, it just might have too much... too many people behind it, too much money, you know, involved, and too many bloggers on its side to stem the tide, you know. So you have to assume right now, at least, you know, everybody's making these predictions, by the way, before any of the reviews have come out. Not a single official review has been posted about Les Mis.
Mm-hmm.
Zero Dark Thirty already has two, and it's also coming out in December.
Mm-hmm.
But that is... what's happening with Les Mis. They're hoping to just ride it on buzz and fandom, and they don't have any great reviews. Well, if it comes out and it starts getting rave reviews from Kenneth Turan and from the New York Times, and it starts getting these scores of 100 and people are saying it's great, it's a masterpiece, well, then I have to reevaluate it. And at that point I will say, okay, so I was wrong. So yeah, it's probably going to get a whole bunch of nominations, you know. So
I think box office too will give us a clue to how big the audience for it is.
See, I don't think it's going to get, other than with theater geeks, I don't think people are going to go, oh my God, you have to go see this movie.
No, I agree, but how many theater geeks are there for it? I mean, millions and millions of people have seen the production either on the West End or on Broadway. It's the most,
right.
one of the most successful productions ever mounted. So all of those people go to see it, then it could well be huge.
They may see it more than once. The people who really love it, they could have some repeat viewings.
Absolutely.
You know, people see it two or three times.
And I feel a lot of excitement around that movie. Like, I feel people really want to see it.
That's kind of what I'm trying to get at. That could happen, and I'm not the person who's going to know whether that's the case or not, because I'm outside of that little bubble. Mm-hmm. I have no idea, but I'm sort of kind of preparing myself for that happening, or at least waiting to see if that's what happens.
Yeah, that's how I feel. Like, I just feel like I can't make any sort of definitive Oscar calls until I hear the critics and the box office. Otherwise, I'm not going to go on just the word of a couple of bloggers, you know? Because
mm-hmm.
I talked to some critics already who aren't going public who are, you know, iffy about it. So I think for me, it's just a wait and see kind of thing with Les Mis. I can't trust my own opinion, so I have to wait and see how the reception is.
One of our really smart readers on the site said that he found that a stat about the fact that 50 million people worldwide have seen this stage production. 50 million people. That's extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
If everyone who saw the play wants to go see the movie, then that's going to add up to a lot of money.
Oh, for sure.
But count it
people who don't even know that it's the play, that, like me, for instance, who mm-hmm. saw the trailer and thought it was going to be good based on that.
On the other hand, though, you know, Sweeney Todd had the Johnny Depp factor going for it, and it only made $52 million domestic. I'm looking at that right now because I was curious about it, and it only made 152 worldwide. You would think that with Johnny Depp and with the subject matter and how fun it was and really, really pretty accessible, that it would have done really a lot more money than that.
Well, Sweeney Todd, and then it got killed by the critics. But look at Phantom of the Opera and Evita. Those are both Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals. And how did they do at the box office? Because both of those were incredibly... Phantom of the Opera, I'm going to guess, is was more popular than Les Mis.
On stage, yes, it was.
Because I totally saw Phantom of the Opera on stage and loved it.
Mm-hmm. I think that
and the movie was horrible.
Up the top ticket sellers in Broadway of all time, and I believe that Phantom of the Opera was number three or four in history.
Really, I thought it overtook second place from.
Oh, maybe
in
it did.
2006.
Yeah. Oh, possibly.
With Cats still being number one.
Oh, Cats. Yeah, right. See, none of these musicals have made very good. The only one that made a good movie was Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Of the recent musicals, you know,
One was uniquely cinematic, I thought. Whereas that's the big problem for me with Les Mis is that it seems very stage bound, but that you add in a bunch of close ups, it just makes it weird.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to look up Evita and see how much.
Evita, you're looking for the box office?
Yeah.
It made, what year did it come out? 1996, it made $50 million domestic and $91 million worldwide. No, $91 million
Opera.
Foreign.
Yeah. Phantom of the Opera, how much did that make?
Let me see here real quick. And that's a long time ago. So that with adjusted for inflation, that's impressive, you know, Phantom of the Opera. So yeah, there is definitely. I think you have I can't underestimate the fact of the number of people who have not only the people who actually were able to make it to Broadway, but people who've seen it in stage productions on the road shows, and also people. There are people who buy this music who have never even seen the play.
Oh yeah, totally. And all the songs are probably more popular than any other.
And in fact, this will be the chance of a lifetime for them to finally see a production of it. They have maybe heard and loved the music all their life and have never been able to see a production of it. So there are those people.
And
you hear the songs a lot, too, in those musical competition shows like American Idol and whatnot. They're almost standards.
Right, right. And you're watching it, you recognize them. Even if you've never seen the musical, you definitely know those songs and you go, oh, yeah.
And you're humming them the next day whether you want to or not.
Oh,
and
my
Phantom
God.
Of the Opera, I found out in 2004, it $51 million domestic. And worldwide total was $154 million.
So they're basically all of them so far, except for Chicago, were $50 million-ish.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a fair reflection of, like, the theater geek demo. So we'll see if Les Mis can break through that. It probably can, you know, especially if it has Oscar buzz and must-see factor, and Anne Hathaway supposedly going to win the Oscar, so people will be drawn in for that, right?
Mm-hmm. Definitely be the person who really makes an effort to try to like it. Although it's not, it's not my cup of tea. It's not this kind of movie I would be immediately drawn to. But except from the fact that it is in the race, and we need to, you know, I need to be informed about it.
Well,
I'm really going to try it.
It's hard to relate to a movie where people are just singing, and never talking. Like for me, that's it. It's hard to identify and connect with the characters unless you already have a connection with them.
I like old musicals because they're quaint. They have I can accept it if they're because that's just the way they did things back in the olden days. But really, modern musicals, I really have a lot of trouble with. The last modern musical that I can stand, but I really love it a lot, is Cabaret. And that was that's an amazing adaptation. You know, the way that they were able to blend and meld the music and the drama in that movie is, Fosse won Best Director, didn't he?
Yeah, it was really close to winning Best Picture, actually.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I love Cabaret, but the interesting thing about it is that apart from a lot of other musicals is that the music in it is all performance-based in terms of it's all stuff happening on a stage somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's removed from the drama. And Singing in the Rain is another one of my favorite musicals, and similar to that. They do songs at random, but they're not emoting necessarily as much through song, whereas... Les Mis is wall to wall singing
and sing acting.
The lack of subtlety with it. We were talking about it being sort of pitched to the cheap seats, but you're brought right up on stage because of the close ups. The overwhelmingness, I think, sort of glides over a lot of the subtleties in the story. I think if you were to watch it again, a lot of the subtleties would come out more. But I think it's a problem with the film that they're not more obvious to begin with.
All you can say is, at worst, it didn't work for you.
Well, you know what I like about so many movies this year, and some other writer, I can't remember who, I saw a headline, I didn't read the article, but we've mentioned it before in a previous podcast. So many directors this year are taking some really interesting stylistic risks.
Yeah.
They're doing things that you would not expect them to do, and most of the time they're paying off. Most of the time the experiments really work, or they work for a lot of people, even if they don't work for the three of us all the time. They're working for a lot of people. Like Craig, you thought that the experiment of Anna Karenina really worked.
Yeah, this is, to me, like Anna Karenina.
Like Pi, Cloud Atlas, and The Master were all really odd, non-conventional stories.
And stylistically and narrative, the narrative doesn't follow any kind of expected formula at all. And I wonder if maybe if there are some critics who are just so accustomed to waiting for certain things to happen at a certain point in the movie, looking for the beats, they call them, you know? And that when those beats don't happen, then the critics are a little bit frustrated and don't understand. A lot of critics just don't understand some of the movies this year.
Well, I feel like of all the movies that I've seen, I saw of the movies that Craig just mentioned, The Master doesn't feel like it's something I haven't seen before. Life of Pi. And I would say that I would put at the top of the list of totally unconventional things I've never seen before that blew my mind, either in a good way or a bad way, but just plain surprised me, was Cloud Atlas, Les Mis, and Anna Karenina. But all three of those were just kind of weirdly outside the box, and it either worked or it didn't. And in my opinion, Cloud Atlas was the only one of those three that their experiment worked on me.
And we haven't seen Craig, you saw Holy Motors, and I guess that's really, that would fit into the same category. Totally something you've never seen before, that you can't compare it to anything else.
Can barely even describe.
Yeah. That's the problem I think a lot of critics and a lot of people, a lot of audiences have, is if you can't ask someone what the movie is about and get a one-sentence answer, then people are confused.
Right.
But
I think
also
we bring a template in our heads to movies. We have certain expectations of them. When movies don't follow that pattern, if we're not inside the weird bubble that they create, then we sit back and we criticize all the choices that they make because they're different than what we expect, and we assume that what we expect is what is right. But if you get inside of that bubble, like I did with Life of Pi and Cloud Atlas and something else that's escaping me, but then you don't even think about the differences. You just let the movie wash over you.
That's right, and I'm sure a lot of people will have that experience about Les Mis. They will feel like they're right inside the bubble. And I know that a lot of people felt that way about Anna Karenina. Anna Karenina is like that in that it's a divisive film. It's a love-it-hate-it movie, and so is Cloud Atlas, and so is Les Mis. They're love-it-hate-it movies. You're either in the bubble or you're not. And I don't necessarily think you can fault a director for trying something like that. You know, you can't say, oh, that's such a shitty movie. Why'd they make that? You just have to say, that's an interesting choice. It didn't work for me particularly, but it's still an interesting choice.
Yeah.
I would rather watch a noble failure than watch a soft, easy-to-go-down movie like Silver Linings Playbook that doesn't do anything except make you feel good that everything's going to end up all right in the end.
Right, same here. Because to me, that's like a cheese pizza. You know, you order it, it satisfies, and you don't remember it the next day, you know.
It's comforting. It doesn't challenge you. It doesn't make you think about anything. It just makes you feel nice.
Makes you feel good, and we're in the business of feel good. So, but we should stipulate that a lot of people love Silver Linings Playbook enough to, like in Craig's Facebook, they're always writing quotes from it, right?
quoting the screenplay, you mean?
Quoting Silver Linings
in the movie. Somebody was quoting it the other day, and it kind of made me roll my eyes.
Because it's like, yeah, that movie, I don't think it's particularly bad. It's just that it's just similar to The King's Speech in that compared to a year where there's such dazzling work, it's really hard to imagine that one being the one that the Academy can agree on as the best. But
It's a chicken soup for the soul platitude.
And it might be the one that they vote for because it's the light, happy, feel-good one of all the films that they're watching. It doesn't require they do any work like with Lincoln. And it doesn't freak them out like a lot of these movies will, just out and out freak them out.
It requires a little bit of work. You have to invent all the lesbian scenes in your head
to make it.
And you have to go home and jerk off 10 times. Don't forget that part.
You have to create that backstory and visualize that because it's not on screen.
And you have to deal with the angry hard on in your pants for 2 hours. That can't be comfortable.
Does
I'm way too jaded for that movie to have given me any kind of a hard on.
I know, right?
Yeah. Oh, crap. I at least need some erect nipples or
something. It's like, where's the porn channel?
A woman pretending to talk about relationships with other women is not enough to get me off.
I know, but the thrill is that it's Jennifer Lawrence and she's 22.
In the book, another thing in the book that I haven't seen any sign of in the trailers, and I actually looked, I do this thing where I was curious about, I looked up Bradley Cooper shirtless, Silver Linings Playbook. He's not shirtless in the movie, right?
I don't know.
In the dance scene in the movie, he's shirtless in the dance thing that they do, and she shaves his chest in the book. So that's, they didn't, we were cheated out of that in the movie, huh?
Yeah, he wears a trash bag on his chest in the movie.
He's trying to be too hard to suck up to the football crowd in this movie. That's what it is. They take out all the stuff that would maybe make that crowd think that they're gay or something, and so that pretty much landed on the floor, and then they pump up the sexuality of the Jennifer Lawrence character.
Saying that she fucked everyone in the office, which is not ever mentioned in the novel at all.
Right.
It's not even, that doesn't exist in the novel. That's just something that they made up for her to say over Raisin Bran.
Zero Dark Thirty, they just finished it. It was basically still a wet print, kind of. And it's 2.5 hours long. And it's about the hunt for Osama bin Laden, but it's really also about how a woman... Mark Bull said that he was really interested in how kind of the women dominated the story, and he found it ironic because, you know, in Al-Qaeda, the women are basically, you know, faceless women. Mm. Totally sexist culture.
Well, and he pointed out how the liberalized Western women are like the ultimate evil to the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
Right. And here's Jessica Chastain, who we find out in the movie was recruited from high school to be to work in the CIA only on the Osama bin Laden case. So it's her whole adult life has been hunting down Osama bin Laden. And she's great. She suffers no fools. Throughout the whole movie, everybody's totally, like, talks down to her and, you know, second-guesses her and always wants the men to speak for her, and except in a few moments where she speaks for herself. She just can't take it anymore. She speaks for herself. And, you know, in our comment section, somebody was saying, oh, the hokey dialogue, because she says, I'm the motherfucker who found the house. But they're idiots, whoever said that. I hope I'm not insulting somebody that's my friend, but...
Because, how is that hokey? I don't understand how that's hokey.
Because they think maybe it's too on the nose. I don't know. But what they miss there is that it's an explosive moment. She's been sitting there. I mean, maybe you'd only get this if you were a woman. I don't know. But she's been standing there as they all kind of talk over her as if she's not even there. As if this isn't her whole doing, this whole thing. Mm. And she gets increasingly frustrated with them because nobody's really taking... It's not like they... You know, Bigelow and Bull would never be so overt as to make it one of those cartoony kind of disrespectful treatment. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be like, you know, I'm trying to think of a movie where, well, like Thelma and Louise.
Where they send her for coffee or something.
Yeah, or like Thelma and Louise, where it's like, you know, suck my dick or whatever. Right. It was never like that, but it's subtle and it's frustrating.
It comes across as a typical action movie one-liner that maybe a Schwarzenegger or a Stallone would have read, but there's a context for it, as Sasha points out. She's in this meeting surrounded by these men. She's done all of this work over the course of like a decade, and she's finally found the place where bin Laden probably lives. And there's all these people talking around her and talking over her. And the guy who's in charge of the meeting, played by James Gandolfini, she speaks up a little bit and she's like, oh, and who's this? She says, I'm the motherfucker who found the house. And the crowd cheers. And it's like, it's a Hollywoodized sort of moment, but there's a meaning to it that makes it much, much deeper and gives it much more context than just a throwaway line.
Yeah, I agree. And a lot of it is the buildup of her frustration, which I could see plainly. And I was really glad that she finally said that because it was frustrating. The first thing they should have said was, here's, and then named her and said, she's the one who, you know, but they don't. Mm-hmm. Everybody always is like on top of her making the more important calls. And they're very nicely partnered films because they're both kind of indirectly about the war on terror. The first one is about the horrors of the Iraq War, which was fought because we could not catch Osama bin Laden, or we used him as an excuse to invade Iraq. But, and then this one is about hunting down Osama bin Laden. So to me, it's like it's this part two of part ones. If you were writing these as beautiful short stories that represented certain eras, they would work hand in hand that way. Like, here's the first part one, and here's part two. And if she does a part three, then she'll have a beautiful Iraq trilogy.
That would be amazing.
Wouldn't it? So that's how I see it. That's how I'm going to write about it. I don't know if anybody else sees it that way, but to me, that's where the genius in this film lies.
Being a guy, I don't see it filtered through a woman's perspective so much. But for me, it works as both. It works on a surface level as a pure. I mean, it's almost the Jason Bourne-iest of Jason Bourne movies. The first 2 hours is all procedural. Them following lead after lead after lead, trying to track down the big guy, and then the final 30 to 40 minutes is the actual mission itself. And just as a pure piece of filmmaking, it works just as an entertainment, but it balances that entertainment with a depth and a richness that's based on A, it being as close to the truth as they could find it, but it's also thematically interesting because it plumbs this whole gray area. There's a part at the very beginning, and it takes place soon after 9/11, and we're still torturing people as a matter of policy.
Right.
And it takes it as a matter of fact, but it doesn't shy away from showing you what that means, what it means to actually torture another human being to get them to tell you what you want them to tell you. And it doesn't shy away from it, but it never passes judgment on it. It never says the people doing it are bad people. It never makes the case whether it's good policy or bad policy. It's simply taking it as a fact of what happened and not shying away from showing it to you. And when you see the results that come out of that torture, and, you know, I don't think there's a single person in this country who isn't glad that Osama bin Laden was eventually killed. Well, he was killed because of a lot of things that they discovered while doing horrible things to people. And so it's not a clear-cut, you know, black and white morality. Right. It makes you really think about what's okay to do and when.
Yeah, right. So a lot of the stuff on torture is going to come up over this. The first thing that's going to happen is people are going to start freaking out over torture. Is the movie pro or against torture? That's what people are going to be asking.
It's neither.
And it's neither, which is same with The Hurt Locker. She was writing about the soldiers. She wasn't necessarily, talking about the right or wrongness of the war. But the right or wrongness of it came through anyway because, you know, these guys were... It was just futile.
Because the wrongness of it is the effect that it has on individual people.
Right, and the futility
by showing
of it.
The impact, which the news media and the government was so afraid of us seeing, it gives you all the information that you need to have to make up your own mind. And knowing that, you're more likely to come down on the side of the negative. And I think the same is true with Zero Dark Thirty in terms of the torture. But it's not the filmmaker saying that. It's you deciding that based on the information that you're given.
Mm-hmm. And for instance, in to me, the really telling scene of The Hurt Locker, which I think is a masterpiece. Zero Dark Thirty to me is a great film, but for me, The Hurt Locker is a masterpiece because of what it's saying about war. I feel like it makes really universal statements. I need more time to ruminate on Zero Dark Thirty before coming to that conclusion, but the two together, partnered together, make up to me kind of a masterpiece, of filmmaking. Both.
Hurt Locker was clear. It was clean. It was intense. It was concise, and it was focused on a very narrow situation. And it's brilliant for having done that. But I tend to respond to things that open up a little bit more and are a little bit more ambiguous and bigger scale. And to me, Zero Dark Thirty felt more ambitious on those terms. That doesn't mean that it's better. It's just bigger, and I respond to that.
Right. So, in The Hurt Locker, to me, the futility of war was played out in the scene where he escapes on the outside of town. He's trying to chase down that terrorist, and he ends up in that house, and he's got his gun up, and they're just like doing their dishes, and he's just stuck there. I mean, to me, that was symbolic. There were two scenes, that scene and the one where he's trying to save his friend, and the friend is filled with bombs and he thinks it's him and it turns out it's not him. Both of those to me were beautifully illustrating the futility of war, how it can drive you totally crazy, how no matter what you do, it's never enough. It's not the right thing. Especially, I'm talking about specifically the war in Iraq, but it could be, you know, extrapolated to other wars.
Mm-hmm. Any war, even supposedly good wars.
Yeah, so Zero Dark Thirty had a similar moment with the Osama bin Laden raid, which we should talk about how great that is. But the Osama bin Laden raid is again, the same thing. We have a mission. We have a fucking insanely adept SEAL team to get in there and do the job, and they're great at what they do, and they've got state-of-the-art equipment. With us versus Al-Qaeda, it's always their cunning versus our might and our power. And they got us on 9/11 with box cutters, despite our billions and billion-dollar military and intelligence, they still got to us. So here's this, like, huge team, like, you know, descending on this house where Osama bin Laden is. And it's women, and it's children, and it's dark little rooms, and it's poverty, and it's shooting this person and shooting that person. And it's so sad. Yet we all want him to die, right? But it's still this old man with this sad little gun in this room. It's not this giant man with muscle. It's not alien in the alien in Aliens. It's not this big giant.
He's not
monster.
He's not even an evil mastermind type.
No, it's this sad man with these women and children around him, crying women and children. And then the first thing they do is they start tearing apart the place to get the hard drives and the tapes. And you know, the brilliance of that movie is that by the end of that, you're not wanting to necessarily feel like it was like, you know, we're the heroes. You don't, it's ambiguous. It's, I'm not saying he's a hero. I'm just saying that the movie didn't take a side. It's not propaganda. It's just telling it like it is. And what it is pretty awful.
And it would have been awful if the movie had been constructed in such a way that when they finally get him, the audience wanted to cheer at that moment, as you would in a regular action movie where you have a villain and the villain is finally dispatched. The audience is like, hell yeah, right, you know. But you don't want to do that in this movie. I'm taking it right.
Well, yeah. There's one line where you're rooting for her to get the guy,
right?
But you're not necessarily happy to see him die. You know, in movies they always have to give you something to root for, like. In Rambo or whatever, they'll have to have the bad guy shoot somebody dead in front of your eyes so that when the hero finally kills him, you're like, yeah, get him, you know?
Yeah, get him back for that.
And in this, they could have done, she could have used a cheap shot, like cutting to the towers falling or, you know, people screaming and a guy jumping out of the building and during 9/11 right before they shoot Osama bin Laden so that you could go, oh, yeah, justified. But she doesn't do that, to her credit. You know, it's awful to watch. It's exciting and everything, and they're doing the job that they've been ordered to do, and it has to be done, you know, per our script, our military script.
As far as that goes, it's in keeping them with the torture, letting you make up your own mind about the torture. You have to make up your own mind about whether it's right to go in and assassinate someone without a trial.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Without making a political point either way, it shows it as to the best of their knowledge it really was. And you can sit there and you can marvel at the technology and the fact that these highly trained men are so great at their jobs and all of the hard effort that went into finding this house at this time. But you can also be horrified by the fact that it's filled with women and children and they're screaming and crying and there's blood and, you know, it's a horror movie in a certain way. And it's not filmed in a way to consciously get you excited, but still, if you're me, maybe this says more about me than needs to be said. I'm still glad we shot the fucker in the face. It still feels good that happened. I don't feel good that I feel good about it, but I do. But that's something that I bring to the movie. It isn't something that the movie is telling me to feel, and it doesn't necessarily encourage me to feel one way or the other.
Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I don't think you feel good. I think we all feel good that he's gone. We don't necessarily feel good the way that he had to be gone, but we're but we're glad that he's gone. We feel good about that. We feel better that that we don't have to worry about him anymore.
Well, the movie makes it clear that you know, she says to Sverry, the guy says, we're not going to chase after Osama bin Laden because we have to worry about the homeland and protecting the homeland and killing people here. And she says, if we kill Osama bin Laden, he'll stop ordering attacks on the homeland. You know, it stops. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can get rid of him, you know, you can start to control better how terrorism is over here. And that's a debatable point. I mean, we don't know that for sure. Nobody knows. Nobody knew at the time if killing Osama bin Laden would just turn him into a martyr.
Right.
You know, that was one of the arguments about not killing him. But nonetheless, he ordered that attack on the U.S. We were supposed to get back. We were supposed to get back at Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda. We're supposed to have a war on them, not a war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, and how many soldiers have died in those wars? It's got to be like upwards of 6,000 U.S. soldiers, not to mention all the innocent women and children who have died in those two wars. And really, all they should have done was this: you know, find him, hunt him down, and shoot him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know. I feel like Craig does. Like, in a way, I'm glad that they got him. You know, if you're gonna plan attacks like that on the U.S. and you're gonna kill that many people, well, you better expect a fucking bullet in the head, motherfucker.
Right. I mean, that, yeah.
You know, you can't do that.
That's the thing. I'm pro having it. I'm glad that it happened, but I'm uncomfortable with the fact that part of me feels good about it, like in a creepy sort of animalistic way. And I remember when it happened and people were out celebrating in the streets, and it actually offended me a little bit, because I kind of felt like, okay, this thing happened. It's a terrible thing. It needed to happen, but I'm not sure that we should be celebrating it and we shouldn't be proud of it. You know, we should almost be a little bit ashamed of it in a certain way.
It should be a solemn occasion. You know,
right.
It doesn't mean we won anything.
No. The people in the towers are still dead.
They're still dead. And
we thought that we're wrapped up and tidy with the bow and everything. That's all taken care of now. But there are still questions about that we should be asking ourselves. And so that's why the movie is good that the movie was made. And that's why it's important that it was made.
Right. It's a powerful tool for people to have these conversations and to ask these mm-hmm. questions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a smart enough movie to not. This is probably the fifth time I've said this in this whole podcast, but the movie's not coming up with the answers for you.
You've been listening to episode 9 of Oscar Podcast with Craig Kennedy from livinginCinema.com, Sasha Stone and Ryan Adams from awardsdaily.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Oscar Podcast, and we will be back next week. The bumper music today was Sex by the 1975 and Paris by SCUM. Thanks for listening.
All the graces of love are over now for you. To the end. To the end. too.